koutou katoa. That is rather badly pronounced Maori for greetings, greetings, greetings to you all. I'm Laurie Chisholm, and it's my great privilege as chairperson of the steering committee to welcome you to this conference and to declare it open. It's really nice to see the familiar faces and meet them again. Our first conference was in 1993, and this is our 23rd. There is an unbroken continuity of annual conferences right back to our origin. It's a kind of a secular apostolic succession, if you will. In 2011, we held a conference on the theme, Pulling Us Back from the Brink. Now, in 2015, we are revisiting this theme, realizing that we've moved even closer to the brink and that pulling back will be more difficult. However, there are also some signs that the public is awakening to the issues. Even the Pope and President Obama are now speaking publicly about climate change. Is the microphone getting a bit loud? No? No? I can move closer. For this conference, we did not want to merely evoke an apocalyptic end of the world mood. So in our publicity, we have set before you two figures, Micawber and Cassandra, one from Charles Dickens, the other from Greek mythology. Micawber is an optimist, Cassandra a pessimist. Micawber is confident that everything will turn out okay. She'll be right. Something will turn up. Cassandra predicts catastrophe, and there are plenty of potential doomsday scenarios to choose from. If you want an example of a contemporary Micawber, try Salem Ismail of the Singularity University, who talks of how disruptive technologies are transforming our world at exponentially increasing rates. Just think of mobile phones, digital cameras, drones, Google cars, solar energy, and DNA mapping. Or you could think of the science historian James Burke, who believes that within 50 years we will each have a personal nanofactory, which will make oil obsolete and bring an end to scarcity of any sort, making money superfluous. If you want an example of a contemporary Cassandra, try James Lovelock, who fears that billions of us will die and the few breeding pairs of people that survive will be in the Arctic, where the climate remains tolerable. I don't think this is an either-or situation. There is a Micawber and a Cassandra within each one of us. We are sometimes pessimistic and sometimes optimistic. Sometimes we worry, and sometimes we just get on with life as though nothing has changed. We are here in this conference to explore these issues, to stand back a bit from the daily news and from everyday life, to gain a perspective, to be willing to change, and to step up to the responsibility that the hour requires of us.
Good afternoon. My name is Shirley Dixon, and it's my pleasure to introduce the speaker who will present the first of this year's conference papers. This is, however, perhaps the most quixotic task of this conference, because it's my honour to introduce the Reverend Professor Sir Lloyd Gehring, who is a man who needs no introduction. Lloyd is not only well known to us, but is admired and respected by us all. He is, to coin a phrase, a living treasure of the New Zealand Sea of Faith. But this is not the only appellation that identifies Lloyd. Let me list some of the other titles and descriptors which Lloyd has garnered over the many years of his life. Presbyterian Minister, Member of the Order of New Zealand, Honorary Doctor of Divinity, Professor of Religious Studies, author, preacher, teacher, New Zealand's premier religious thinker and commentator, internationally recognized scholar of religion, but also disturber of our peace and heretic. Which brings me to this journal. This is the current issue of the Fourth Hour, a journal of the West Star Institute. And if you don't recognise that name, think Jesus Seminar. The West Star Institutes is an American educational association that aims to foster, and I've copied this off their website, to foster collaborative, cumulative research in religious studies and to communicate the results of the scholarship of religion to a broad, non-specialist public, which, to us in New Zealand, is particularly through books published by their publishing arm, the Polebridge Press, including several by Lloyd, and through its journal, the Fourth R, a bi-monthly magazine that publishes scholarly religious studies research in non-technical language. As to the name of this journal, the Fourth R, think reading, writing, arithmetic, and add religion as the Fourth R. Now, the reason that I'm bringing all of this to your attention is that this current issue is devoted to one scholar, which is a signal honour. And the scholar, of course, as you can if you can see the cover, is Lloyd. This is a salient recognition of the outstanding contribution that Lloyd has made to religious scholarship. The timing of this publication recognises the publication 50 years ago of four of the papers that led to Lloyd's so-called heresy trial in 1967. And by the way, I think I'm correct in saying this is already on the bookstall, and I can highly recommend it's worth every penny of the $10 that it costs. So, before I ask Lloyd to address the conference topic of responding to an increasingly uncertain future, I would like to remind you of a comment by Lloyd, which he said, "Hope grows not out of some prefabricated future, but from the depths of our genuine relationships with one another and with the earth. So let us not forget those other essential titles by which Lloyd is known: husband, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and friend." Lloyd.
Good afternoon, everybody. In 1997, I had the good fortune to spend some months at Oxford, England. My late wife, Elaine, was using the opportunity we had there to do some research for the doctorate she was working on. And she assumed that I would be at a loose end, so she said to me, "You'd better write a book to fill in the time." And as I also had access to the famous Bodleian Library, I spent some weeks there reading and pondering the question posed by the approach of year 2000. This was already beginning to raise real interest. Perhaps it shouldn't have, but it did. Some looked forward to the new millennium with keen anticipation, expecting it to bring in a golden age of unprecedented prosperity, made possible, of course, by our increased and expanding knowledge and technology. But others were approaching 2000 with real foreboding, fearing that the third millennium, perhaps even the first century of it, would bring a crisis of colossal proportions. In 1997, the attitudes represented by both Micawber and Cassandra were already very much in evidence, as you may well remember. Now, it was in these circumstances that I came to write the book that was published in 1999 as The World to Come. I deliberately chose as the title The phrase, you know, ends the Nicene Creed. In the Nicene Creed, of course, it refers to the life beyond the grave, to which Christians had long looked forward. But during the 20th century, a great change had taken place. We had come to accept that this present life is the only life we shall ever live. And that can be well illustrated by your own experience of the radical change that took place in the funeral services during the 20th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, it was, of course, a send-off to the next world. By the end of the 20th century, most services had become a celebration of a life that had come to an end. So the phrase, the world to come, that I chose for the book, now means the future of human life on planet Earth. Now, are we to move into it with confidence or with foreboding, the foreboding that Cassandra represents? As soon as my research had got underway, I realised that the reaching of the year 2000 had no significance in itself whatsoever, because it simply derives from a convention imposed upon our numbering of the years, and a convention imposed by our Christian forebears. The idea of numbering the years of our calendar from the birth of Jesus Christ was first proposed as late as the 6th Christian century by the Christian monk Dionysius Exiguus. And up until then, Christians were still using the Roman calendar, which they had inherited from the Roman Empire. And that system dated the years from the legendary foundation of the city of Rome. But in the meantime, Christians had come to regard the birth of Jesus, Son of God, as an event far more important than the founding of Rome. Indeed, for them, it was an event of such cosmic significance that it cut human history in two, and we've been used to that ever since. So Dionysius proposed that the Roman year 753 should be changed into 1 AD, Anno Domini, and by his reckoning, that made the year of his proposal 525. So our year 2000, marking the end of a millennium, is no more than a human convention. Nothing to do with reality otherwise. And this convention was never adopted outside the Christian world, so that Jews, Muslims, Indians, Chinese have all continued to use their own original systems of numbering the year, and we in the Christian world tend to forget that. Moreover, the religious convictions on which Dionysius made his calculations have, of course, become outmoded. We no longer see the birth of Jesus as cutting human history in two. We no longer see it as a cosmic event. What is more, Dionysius made a miscalculation of some 4 to 6 years. And so, not surprisingly, when the year 2000 came, nothing of any significance happened at all. On the other hand, the traditional Christian convictions suffered such erosion during the 20th century as I set out in part one of that book, that it became clear we were coming not only to the end of a millennium, more importantly, we were coming to the end of the Christian era. And this conviction made me bold enough. Why is that doing that? Bold enough to follow the lead of Dionysius. And so I suggested in this book that we should take the opportunity to replace the year 2001 with the year 1GE, the first year of the global era. Of course, since my proposal lacked the papal authority that Dionysius had, it's hardly surprising that nothing came of it. I had suggested global era because the period of time in which we now live is the first period in human history when the human species are being forced to become one global community, one in which people of all nations and races and cultures and religions are becoming intermingled as they never were before, with each influencing the others. Now, one of the first to foresee this phenomenon occurring was Teilhard de Chardin. Teilhard de Chardin observed that before the 20th century, there were always more places for humans to travel to, unknown places that had never been visited before. And he observed that the most extensive expansion of humanity had actually taken place in the three centuries, 1600 to 1900. And well exemplified by the growth of the European empires. And during the 20th century, both polar caps were reached, the highest mountains were conquered, and human expansion at last had no new place to go to, other than, of course, later, the moon. Now, what was happening, he observed, was that human beings, having covered the earth, were now beginning to fold back upon themselves in a new way. And he called this process the humanization of the world. Teilhard also called it planetization. And he compared the spread of humanity around the globe to the lines of longitude on the Earth. As they move from a pole, they diverge more and more from one another until they reach the equator. At the equator, they begin to converge as they move steadily towards the other pole. Now, in the spread of the humanity around the globe, he said, human species have now reached a kind of symbolic equator. It's a very interesting concept that he introduced here, because now we are being forced to recognize one another and to live together in an increasingly global community. That is a picture meant to see how the lines of convergence reach the equator and then move together into. And that was the symbol image that he used in order to draw our attention to a very significant thing that is happening to humankind. Now, this process of planetization, which I prefer to call simply globalization, is proceeding without anyone directing it. There's no possibility now of reversing it. No possibility whatsoever. People representing the Micawber role are fully confident that with our creative human enterprise, coupled perhaps with a bit of muddling here and there, will cause us to form a new kind of human existence, one that will be more wonderful and exciting than anything we can imagine. Indeed, it will be a veritable heaven on earth. But those who share the attitude of Cassandra see only storm clouds ahead, one that convey a message of ultimate doom. And that's the dilemma we are attempting to explore a little further and understand a little more clearly in this conference. Now, the storm clouds on the horizon are very real. Make no mistake about that. This is no time for any easy optimism. And they are found on two main fronts. In the world to come, I discussed them under two headings: humanity at war and with itself, and humanity at war with the earth. Now, the first of these, humanity at war with itself, was, of course, brought to our attention by the two world wars, followed by the Cold War. And almost as soon as the 21st century arrived, hostilities broke out in a more complex form and, of course, are still continuing. Martin Luther King summed up the situation when he said, "We must learn to live together or we will not live at all." Now, the second area of concern, our destruction of planet Earth, was first brought to our attention by Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. "We are polluting our rivers with pesticides," she said. Why, it seems quite simple compared with what we can say now. But that was the beginning, because only from the last two decades of the 20th century have we become increasingly aware of the way in which the human species is endangering its future. This is due to two main causes: the exponential growth of the human population, coupled with our rapid expansion of technology. Now, to appreciate the significance of exponential growth, I want to put before you an illustration that I got from Dennis Meadows. And it's simply this. Take a piece of paper, fold it over. Fold it over again. How thick will it be when you folded it 40 times? Take a guess. It would reach from here to the moon. Unbelievable. Of course, the last three or four folds are what really count. Now, we had been indirectly warned about population growth more than 200 years ago by Thomas Malthus of his famous book, Essay on the Principle of Population. Malthus was a clergyman, a political commentator, an Enlightenment thinker, which meant that as he searched for his answers, he was sure he could find some natural law why there were always poor people. He looked for a law, like a law of gravity, to explain this perpetuation of the poor. He believed that he had found the answer in his quest when he observed that population increases by geometric progression, but the food supply can only increase by arithmetic progression. And geometric progression is a particular example of exponential growth. Now, this means that the population will always increase faster than the supply of food available, and as a consequence, there will always be a section of the population who are hungry. One is strangely reminded of the words of Jesus, found in three Gospels: "The poor you will always have with you." Now, Malthus discovered a natural reason for this. No living species, including Homo sapiens, can ever expand in population beyond what the habitat will supply it with food. So food is a limiting to the population. Of course, Malthus could not foresee the introduction of contraceptives, nor could he see that the Industrial Revolution would greatly magnify food production. And so his theory fell out of favour for quite some time. Now it's returning again. Because on the one hand, the population has increased sevenfold in only 200 years. To see how it's added, we'll just put each, as each billion comes, you can see how it's increasing very fast until we've got now 7 billion in 200 years. And you see the line that's growing exponentially like that. And what we have come up against is the finiteness of the earth, which had never really dawned upon the human mind before. The world was so big compared with the little place where one lived. It seemed to be almost infinite, but in fact it is finite, and human activity is growing at such a rate that it has now come up against that particular limit. So the problem that worried Malthus led to the formation in 1968 of a group of high-level politicians, government officials, diplomats, scientists, economists, business people, about 100 in all from around the world, and they simply described themselves as world citizens with a common concern for the future of humanity. They became known as the Club of Rome in 1972. and they published a book after two or three years called Limits to Growth. It sold 30 million copies in more than 30 languages. Now, this report concluded that in a basically the closed system, like the Earth, it's impossible for the population, food production, industrialization, the exploitation of natural resources, and pollution of the environment to continue to experience exponential growth without collapsing. And the Club of Rome forecast that the collapse would come in the second half of the 21st century, unless steps were taken immediately to counter it, because they were still hopeful. The Club of Rome called for a Copernican revolution of the mind. one which abandoned the commitment to endless economic growth and set instead as a goal zero population growth, a levelling off of industrial production, increased pollution control, and a shift from consumerism to a service-based economy. Now, the Club of Rome believed it was still possible to do something positive about their forecast. However, they were met with strong opposition because the collective mind of the humans found it very difficult to come to terms, as I said a little while ago, to the fact that we live in a finite earth. And those who would have been most affected by the Club of Rome's predictions strongly criticized them for what they did. 20 years later, they published another book called Beyond the Limits, in which they asserted it was no longer possible to do anything about it. And they formed a kind of think tank, which exists today, comprising mainly of young people who are trying to identify and solve the problems as well as they can. Now, back in 1999, I outlined 10 possible scenarios of the 21st century. You'll find them in the book. They're not alternatives, for each may exacerbate the others, and the cumulative effect of several could only be disastrous. Well, what do they look like 20 years later? The first was a thermonuclear holocaust. Alas, even though the tension of the Cold War has now largely ceased, there's a tendency just at this very moment for Russia and America to be in opposite sides again. By the year 2000, the arsenals of nuclear weapons still remained, but we hoped they would never be used. There was a wide agreement that the use of nuclear weapons would be utter madness. I can't see that going on. Oh, there. So, but it's cut off from the bottom. This is on to scenario two now. And just to finish off the nuclear fear, we have an added fear now in that nuclear weapons may fall into the hands of terrorists. Now, my scenario two was World War III. Well, we had no sooner entered the 21st century when the infamous 9/11 occurred with the destruction of the Twin Towers, and that immediately then led to the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, resulting with the present chaotic position in the Middle East, which is far from having a solution in sight. Someone who came with me on the Middle East tours in the 90s said to me only a few days ago, Syria was such a peaceful place when we went through. Not so now. We shall perhaps soon be welcoming refugees from Syria. Now, the great Western powers face a dilemma. How can they promote a peace process from outside the Middle East without being dragged into the conflict, thus initiating a third world war. Now, if this situation had arisen 100 years ago, World War III would already have occurred. Although that's a little logical to say so. I say that because today, unlike 100 years ago, the Western powers are very wary of doing anything that will promote a world war. And that, of course, is a very healthy sign. But it doesn't mean that we'll be able to avoid it. My third scenario was the rise of authoritarian dictatorships. And when there is increased tension and inequality of wealth, democracies find it difficult to take the necessary steps to restore harmony and equality. And such situations call for strong leadership, and that is how dictatorships arise. There you will see on this picture a few of them. Indeed, one have to say that in the year 2000, there were 50 countries ruled by dictators. But I must hurry on with these scenarios. So, scenario 4. We are no nearer feeding the world's hungry. First, because although we do have an abundance of food, we are unwilling to share it unless people pay for it. That's the problem. And the rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer. And the contrast between the two has increasing rapidly all the time. And these are becoming more common because of the climate change. In the 20th century, 70 million people died of starvation. We're not in the countries where we can see this, and so we tend to forget about it. Then on another front altogether, scenario 5 is that of pandemics. Now, medical science is engaged in a touch-and-go struggle all the time with the fast-evolving microorganisms such as AIDS, Asian flu, avian flu, and so on. And we have to remember that the Spanish flu of 1918 to 20 killed 50 to 100 million people. Scenario 6, the destruction of the ecological balance. In the intervening 20 years, we have become increasingly aware of this problem. That's a very healthy sign. Global warming has made its reality felt in ferocious storms, the melting of the glaciers, and the melting of the ice shelf. 14 of the 15 hottest known countries were in the 21st century. The evidence is now irrefutable, though, of course, there are still non-believers. And in addition, we are polluting the air and water, the two most basic necessities of life. Although we're now becoming more ecologically conscious, we've got a long way to go. Scenario 7. George Soros, a Hungarian Jew who has become one of the 9 richest men in the world, but who is also a student of Karl Popper, of fame here in New Zealand. He has written 3 books warning us that the global economy faces a collapse. because the capitalist monetary system, which depends upon economic growth, is very seriously flawed. Now, his three books, The Alchemy of Finance, 87, The Crisis of Global Capitalism, 1998, The New Paradigm of Financial Markets, 2008. People greeted his books and believed he was simply crying wolf, to which he answered, "Remember, it was when the third wolf was cried, the wolf actually came." So that's a very unsettling prophecy from a man we mightn't have expected to be making this. And when we realize that our own government, like all other governments, regards the economic growth as the chief criterion to measure its success, it has very serious consequences in the long run. We are now more aware of scenario number 8, the global spread of terrorism. The 21st century had hardly begun when we had 9/11. And it triggered, of course, a whole string of hostilities which are at a very dangerous state at this moment. The invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, suited the interests of Al-Qaeda and led directly to the rise of ISIS. Terrorism is now spreading on a global front. In 2014, the Institute for Economics and Peace drew up a terrorism index. Since 2000, there has been a fivefold increase. In 2000, some 3,361 were killed. In 2014, 17,598 were killed. In other words, there is an increase in what terrorists are now managing, the damage they're managing to do. We're reminded of this threat, as we were this morning when we came on the air, every time we board a plane. Can you remember the time when you could simply walk onto the plane without any examination of your luggage at all? Those were halcyon days which seemed to have gone forever. So in skipping through the 8 scenarios I've done so far, we must conclude that none of them have disappeared, and 3, the ones that I've here marked in red, 3 have actually become considerably more intense. Now, despite the warnings of the Club of Rome, the majority of the human population show very few signs of being aware of these dangers, the dangers voiced by Cassandra. Now, the vast majority of people, particularly in Africa and India, have not even heard the warning because their attention, understandably, is completely focused on where the next meal is coming from. That's of more interest to them than what's going to happen in the future. And most of the people in the Western world still tend to adopt the optimistic and Macaulay-like attitude towards life on this planet. "She'll be right, mate. Something will turn up." Now, is that easygoing, hopeful optimism supported by any evidence? Well, in the world to come, I discussed this scenario under number 10, saving ourselves and the planet. And the first thing to be acknowledged is that only we humans can do it. Now, that didn't used to be the case, or didn't seem to be the case once. For all people of the Christian world of the past, and for all conservative Christians of the present, it's not we who will decide these things. They believed that their ultimate destiny and that of the world was not in their hands, but in the hands of an all-powerful, benevolent God to whom they could appeal to be delivered. Indeed, when Christianity came to birth, there was a widespread expectation of the imminent end of the world, one in which they would be raptured, to use the phrase taken up by American fundamentalists. The New Testament is permeated by this. It's what scholars call the eschatological theme running through the New Testament. Eschatological is the adjective from the Greek word eschata, which means the last things or the last times. So when you read the New Testament, look out for how often it says in the last days. And it was expected to be a time when God would break into history and replace the old heaven and earth with a new heaven and earth. The words come from the book of Revelation. Now today we have a very different view, a very different picture of the universe, and the hopes of deliverance imagined by the first Christians has now become completely obsolete. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer well put it, humanity has now come of age. And in our long and slow cultural evolution, humanity has reached that point in our cultural and religious development that can be likened to that of the young adult who is just beginning to move out of parental control and must now take full responsibility for his or her actions. That is the present state of Homo sapiens with regard to the earth. And like the young adult, leaving the protection of home and parental control, we humans now find we're on our own. There is no one out there to help us. There are no divine forces to which we can appeal. Our destiny, both as individuals and as a species, is in our own hands. We can help one another, but we are all humans together. Moreover, we find to our alarm that we now carry increasing responsibility for all other earthly species as well. And in the meantime, we have been destroying other species at a very fast rate. Now, before proceeding to discuss how we're to shoulder this responsibility, let me point to one more thing. I first learned this again from Taya de Chardin, who, of course, remained a devout Roman Catholic to the day of his death. But he made this surprising statement. If, as a result of some interior revolution, I were to lose in succession my faith in Christ, my faith in a personal God, my faith in spirit, I feel that I should continue to believe invincibly in the world. The world, its value, its infallibility and its goodness, that, when all is said and done, is the first, the last, and the only thing in which I believe, or if which you can translate, in which I trust. It is by this faith that I live, and it is to this faith that at the moment of death, rising above all doubts, I shall surrender myself. It's an extraordinary statement coming from such a devout Catholic. And why had he come to that? Well, it was his study of the process of evolution. It had filled him with such awe and hope as he observed the extraordinary capacity of matter. The basic stuff of the universe organizes itself against the second law of thermodynamics, right? It organizes itself into ever more complex entities. Atoms coalesce to form molecules. That took about 30 billion years. Atoms coalesce to form molecules, and megamolecules coalesce to form living cells. And cells have the capacity to multiply together and support one another to form organisms. And organisms join in relationship to form communities. So that, if you see these, observing this awe-inspiring process, Teilhard's imagination projected it into the future and suggested that humanity, though suffering now as it reaches this time of convergence on one another with all its tensions, nevertheless, it is reaching a stage in which it's the birth pangs of a new kind of global community. Now, in this coming global community, individual persons will work together in love for the common good in the same way as the billions of cells in our body work together for the common good of the total organism. Unless, of course, rogue cells get in the way, and the rogue cells are cancers. So he can use, as it were, the evolution of the human body as a kind of image or model of the evolution of the human species. A coming global community is a genuinely realizable hope for the future, if we allow for the goodwill present in the human heart and the inventive character of the human mind. We need to take those into account as we face this uncertain future. But there are no grounds for any easy optimism. Just as it took a World War I to form a League of Nations, it took a World War II to form the United Nations. So, what will it be? What catastrophe will we face in the future that will bring about a world government? In my own view, the United Nations is already due for a radical review in which the power of veto is taken away from the Great Five, and the United Nations is allowed to become a truly democratic form of world government. Now, this is the message of Dennis Meadows, who has become the chief spokesman for the Club of Rome. He was only in his 20s when he first became a member of the Club of Rome. He used to work at MIT before that. He's now a grey-headed man who travels the world giving lectures, warning that the political management of such a complex system as planet Earth can no longer be trusted to traditional states. And the reason for that, when you look at it, is very simple. He says, they are wedded to the notion of measuring their success by the criterion of economic success, which, of course, can only in the long run spell disaster. And what is more, democratic governments face election every 3 or 4 years, and so they are not able to plan for long-term future. Now, Meadows finds that the nation-state is too large to tackle small local problems where we have local government, but it's too small to tackle global problems. They have to be tackled by a global form of government that is a redesigned form of United Nations. A much better coordinated system is needed, he said, incorporating international and supranational institutions as well, because in the end, after all, some of the international corporations have more power than either governments or the United Nations. Now, another person we can think of is Al Gore, one-time president of the... What a tragedy it is that he did never become president, because here is a man who had a wonderful grasp of what we face in the future. But he, like Meadows, spends his time going around the world lecturing, explaining the massive climate change that we're caught up in and warning of impending dangers. And some of you, I'm sure, will have seen the inconvenient truth. Shirley and I saw it in Queensland, and we're rather interested that the audience that afternoon were practically all young people. And when the film finished, they burst into loud applause, which I'd never heard seen at a cinema before. So those young people who are going to live through this future, as most of us will not, of course, they're the ones who are rightly concerned and hopefully will be able to have their views expressed. Now, if our future is now in our hands, what must we do to save ourselves and the planet? Well, first of all, we must acknowledge that we've all got to make some changes. Think globally and act locally is a very good motto for that. And we must take positive and active steps to nurture the growth of global community. Indeed, it is at this point that the values we have absorbed from the Christian tradition and reflected in the concept of the kingdom of God become extremely relevant. Now, if we do not do so, and do not do so within sufficient time, the human race may well become extinct even within this century. So, to respond to the above eight scenarios voiced by Cassandra, I'm suggesting 10 guiding principles for life. 1. Acknowledge our common humanity, irrespective of race, culture, gender, age, or sexual orientation. We are all humans, and we all face the future together. 2. Abandon violence and war. And it's good that, as I said before, things are better now than they were 100 years ago. We no longer glory in war, and we must avoid it as long and as much as we possibly can. 3. Solve our differences by peaceful negotiating, starting, of course, at the local level. That's how to solve problems, and then from there we can go to do it further afield. 4. Acknowledge that we are earth creatures who are dependent upon this life for life, this world for life. We have evolved out of the dust of the earth in a marvelous way that evolution has had, and we are therefore responsible back to the earth for all of our actions. Then, 5, cooperate with nature instead of trying to master it. Right up until the 20th century, we saw that nature was something to be mastered for our purposes. Now our future depends upon what goes on in nature, and so we need to cooperate with it. Then replace the political goal of economic growth with that of sustainability. 7. Move from a carbon-based source of energy to the use of solar energy. 8. Reduce waste by recycling. Now that's something that nature does exceedingly well. Think of the way in which the waste of the animal bodies and so on becomes the way in which new growth is promoted. Manure is a very interesting thing in itself, in the cycle it performs in nature. 9, overcome pollution of air and water. And finally, aim for zero population growth. Now, some of these things, fortunately, we have already started. But there is an urgency built into this all, and only time will tell whether we have started too late. You may have heard that Martin Rees, astrophysicist, published a book in 2003 with the rather alarming title, Our Final Century. Will the human race survive survive the 21st century? Humanity, he says, is more at risk than at any earlier phase in its history. And he gives us a 50-50 chance of surviving. It's over to us. And I'd like to finish with some words for the Bible, because in the book of Moses, we have a very interesting set of words set before us. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life, that you and your descendants may live. These words, coming from at least 2,500 years ago, are remarkably relevant to us today. And so that is the end.
Before I thank Lloyd very briefly for his wonderful talk, we have time for a very few questions. There's a roving mic down the front, so anybody who would like to ask a question, so long as it's snappy, please.
Brian Ellis, I was only reading this morning the text, I think, is in the New York Tribune article on ISIS, and there's a number of statements in there which dealing with the threat that this has to the rest of the world, and I was interested to read at towards the end of it that the move by or the reluctance of the Western world to engage in direct warfare was being resisted strongly, and yet we have here a very severe threat to the rest of the world and civilization. What is your response to that and dealing with it if we are not to use violence, recalling, of course, the problem we have in dealing with the theology that ISIS proclaims?
I haven't any solution, unfortunately. I think, however, to take steps which would escalate the war will only make things worse. Now, there are some who say, well, the West should keep out of this and let the Middle East solve its own problems. There's a certain amount of value in that advice, and it's the real problem is, as a matter of fact, in the Dominion, our famous cartoonist had put it very well this morning, because he had Russian, let me see if I can remember this, he represented Russia as bombing ISIS in order to help Assad, while the West was in fact can't quite get it now, and that'll spoil it, because he was showing the difficulties that are there, because we have two different types of enemies in the Middle East. ISIS, which is the fundamentalist uprising, and Assad, who is a dictator who has killed large numbers of his own Syrian people. And this is the quandary that the West and Russia have. Russia believe that by bombing, by supporting Assad, they will be able to conquer ISIS, whereas the America and the West don't want to be either supporting Assad or ISIS, and so we have a three-way conflict here, which we've never had, so far as I can remember, before. It's always been two sides, and you join one or the other, And that is why, by not allowing or not encouraging the West to participate in any military way, but trying to let the situation sort itself out locally, has a lot to be said for it. But I don't see any easy solution, I'm afraid.
With all that was gone on with your talk, should the government allow euthanasia? Should you be asking a 97-year-old man that question?
So the question is about euthanasia?
Yes.
Oh, yes. It will eventually come, but of course there are problems with that too. And I quite agree, I quite understand why people are opposed to legalising euthanasia. It can open up all sorts of difficulties, and it can only be opened up under strict restrictions. But it will come, because we haven't the right to keep a person alive by medical means. And we're keeping them alive by medical means. Most of these people would have been dead before. And have we the right to insist that they keep on living if, in fact, life has now become of negative value? Once it's reached negative value, then life is worthless.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'm in your way.
No, that's fine. It's all these cords. At the beginning, it is now my pleasure to thank Lloyd. At the beginning, Lloyd reminded us that this present life is the only life we have. And Tir de Chardin put his faith in the world, his trust in the world, in the goodness of the world. So, to finish, can I suggest that we go to afternoon tea determined to live hopefully, to live in love, and to live this day as though it was the most important day of our lives. Thank you, and thank you, Lloyd, very much. Thank you.